The rough and tumble battles of an election year are nothing compared to the fights Barney Ross faced during his life. In fact, I just finished reading a new biography of Barney Ross by Douglas Century, and it tells the fascinating story of Barney Ross's life. He rose from the streets of the Jewish ghetto on Chicago's Near West Side to the top of the boxing world, and Douglas Century is with us now in studio to talk more about the life and times of Barney Ross. Reading through this story, Doug, it's amazing just all of the people that he was connected with over the course of his life, having died in the late 1960s. What was it that drew you to this story?
Well, there's sort of been this giant memory hole in our culture. This was a man that was one of the most famous athletes of the 20th century. He was also a great war hero. And yet within boxing circles, he's largely forgotten. I mean, old-timers will know about him. Within Jewish American circles, he's largely forgotten. And even here in Chicago, I mean, I'm sitting in the epicenter of Barney Ross's world right now, Navy Pier. If you were within a mile radius of everything that Barney knew, he's forgotten in this great city as well. And I think I wanted to rediscover his story. It was also a hugely inspirational story because he was fighting his whole life. I mean, his father got murdered, as you know from the book, and this was just a guy that never gave up and had the sweetest disposition in spite of all the pain he'd been through in his life.
Let's talk a little bit about some of those key events. You mentioned the murder of his father, which happened when he was growing up in the Maxwell Street neighborhood.
Sure.
And what's interesting is how that affected Barney Ross's life thereafter. You say that he was really sort of an unlikely boxer if you looked at his family life and even looked at him. Why?
Well, he came from an Orthodox Jewish background. His father was a man named Itchik or Isaac. Rasovsky. So the family name, they had come from the old country. The family name was Rasovsky. There are still relations here in Chicago that go by Rasov. And I was very lucky to get to know Barney's last surviving sibling, George Rasov, passed away in 2004, unfortunately. But the truth of it is they were brought up to believe that, as his father would say, let the atheists be the trumpeniks, is a Yiddish word meaning troublemakers, the street toughs. We're the scholars. But Barney's father had a little nondescript dairy grocery store on Jefferson Street in back then. This was, of course, the Lower East Side of Chicago. The Maxwell Street ghetto was just teeming with crime and violence. And even though Barney had been brought up his father had wished him to be a Talmudic scholar and a Hebrew teacher, when his father was murdered and Barney really watched his father die in his arms, the youngest siblings, George and Sam and a daughter, Ida, were sent to an orphanage. And Barney vowed, I'm going to make enough money somehow in my life that I'm going to get my kid brothers and sister out of the orphanage, Mark Smathan Orphanage on the west side of Chicago. And he did. And it started off just being what he called a pawn shop fighter. You would be an amateur going around knocking guys out, and you know, you'd win a watch or a pair of shoes and you'd pawn it off. He never really thought he'd make a profession of it, but he was good. He was also an unlikely fighter because he was a small man and asthmatic, underweight. He just wasn't designed. But Jewish fighters were always the sort of master scientific pugilists, unlike Italian-American fighters, which, you know, the great Italian-American fighters are often known for taking three punches to the head, the Carmen Basilio, Jake LaMotta, I can come back at it. You know, you can't hurt me. But the Jewish fighters like Benny Leonard, who was immediately the forebear to Barney Ross, and Barney Ross were just known as stylists. They would say of Benny Leonard that his hair was never messed up in the ring, which was that's farcical, of course. But the truth is, Jewish fans like to see a stylist, and so Barney wasn't a knockout artist, but he was a beautiful fighter. And his fights, you can still watch them for a how-to of footwork and defensive moves. His brother George told me, my brother was a real smart fighter, and I wondered what did he mean by that. But you would conserve your energy and put on little flurries with 10 seconds left in the round, and you know, the judges would see how good you were. That's being clever and being ring wise.
The high point of his career as a boxer really came in a series of bouts with Tony Canzanieri and Jimmy McLaren in the 1930s. What was it that characterized these fights that made them so significant?
Well, of course, you have to remember there's always a correlation between poverty and boxing. So now, even more than black Americans, the Latino Americans, Latinos in general, are the dominant group, most successful fighters. But at that era, in the late 1920s and 30s, there were, of course, the great waves of immigration. So you still had Irish fighters coming out of the Irish tough neighborhoods. And you had Italian-American fighters and you had Jewish-American fighters. So that was the other reason I thought this was a great story, because in 1933, Barney is challenging. Tony Canzanieri was the reigning lightweight champion of the world, a really tough, beautiful fighter, completely unorthodox, always kept his guard down and could move his face away from you like Muhammad Ali would later do. And he was really an unorthodox, beautiful fighter that Barney thought was the best he ever fought. And here in Chicago Stadium in 1933, Barney beat him for the lightweight championship of the world. And then they had a rematch in New York. Barney won again. So Barney's the reigning lightweight champion. The other great fighter of the era was a welterweight named Jimmy McLaren out of Belfast and living in Vancouver, Canada. He was really strong welterweight that could knock a lot of guys out. And he had knocked out a series of Jewish fighters, six or seven great Jewish fighters in a row, Kid Kaplan and Ruby Goldstein, ending with Benny Leonard, who was past his prime, had come back after the Wall Street crash because he lost his money. And McClarnon knocks him out too. So the press starts calling him the Jew beater and the scourge of the fighting sons of Israel. So Barney in 1934 in New York City is facing him in May 28th, 1934. Then they had the Madison Square Garden Bowl outside, and the lightweight champion had never won the welterweight championship, and it was a huge moment for American Jews especially because, of course, Nazism was on the rise in Europe. Yes. And even in America. Barney really felt, I'm fighting for my whole, you know, the good name of my people, to show that we were brave. And it was an epic. They fought three times. McClarnon and Ross fought three times in one calendar year. Barney won two of the three. And he really emerged as the greatest fighter of his generation. In that era when all the ethnic groups were represented, Barney, the Jewish boy from Maxwell Street, was the pride of the ghetto. He kind of came out on top, largely through his incredibly smart strategy in the ring.
We're talking here on 848 on Chicago Public Radio with Douglas Century, who's written a new biography of Barney Ross, who was one of the greatest boxers of the 20th century and from Chicago, also went on to become an American war hero. You write in this book that after that third bout with Jimmy McClarnon, a bout that Ross won, that he should have ended his career there. Why?
Yeah. Well, because he was a very self-destructive guy outside of the ring. One of the sports writers said the ropes shielded him from the world. Inside that squared circle, he was a beautiful, confident, furious machine. But outside of it, first of all, he wasn't violent. He had no mean streak, unlike a friend of his from the old neighborhood, Jack Ruby, who was a psychopath.
And this is Jack Ruby, of course, of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, they all grew up on the West. At that point, Maxwell Street was the Jewish ghetto, but then the Jews tended to move a little bit west down Roosevelt Road, Lawndale area was what they called the West Side. And there was a whole bunch of rough, tough characters out there, Jewish gangsters. And Barney came from that world. But, you know, coming up in the 30s, Barney's style and everything elevated him above that, the class of people he came from. And Ruby was a guy that absolutely idolized Barney Ross. Barney, you know, later in the Warren Commission, I think I mentioned that in the book, is interviewed by the FBI. They want to find out who are the sort of West Side gangster characters that Jack Ruby was connected to. And it turned out Jack Ruby had been at every one of Barney Ross's fights. And there was a quote in the book saying, if you were from the West Side, you had to be a follower of Barney Ross. He just emerged as the sort of the greatest guy from this Chicago neighborhood. And I really think it's a tragedy that he's been forgotten in Chicago, because one of the things I hope happens with this book is that we reintroduce him to a whole generation of young Chicagoans.
You were talking just a moment ago how he was sort of protected by the ring because outside of it he had all of these other influences, and he had some personal demons as well.
Yeah.
Loved to gamble, loved to be at the horse track, those kinds of things.
Well, I meant to answer your question. That's why I said he should have retired after McClarnon, is that was the high point of his career. And he was the greatest of his generation in the ring, but he was blowing all his money at the track. Famously, he took one purse, I think it was about $80,000, and he bet eight races wrong in a row. And he couldn't hold on to his money. So, he keeps beating guys, but ultimately by 1938, he fights a very, very skilled featherweight named Henry Armstrong. They called him Homicide Hank or the little perpetual motion machine, and he just bowled Barney Ross. And Barney really should – he took a bad beating in that fight, and he really
stayed in far longer than he should.
Yeah, well, his managers and the referee kept saying, Barney, stop it. And he said, no, you know what? I came into the ring on my feet. I'm going out. He'd never been knocked out. He'd only barely been knocked down once or twice in the ring, but he'd never been knocked out. And he said, a champ's got a right to choose the way he goes out. He's just pummeled for the end of the fight. And it really, unfortunately, that's what a lot of people remember about his career, because it was so courageous. But it was just a question of, I think, you know, he was a very conditioned man, but he also loved to smoke and drink. And he just didn't have a lot of self-discipline outside of the ring.
One of the most amazing things about this story, though, is he retires after that bout. And then a few years later, as World War II is beginning and American involvement commences following the attack on Pearl Harbor, he, at the age of 33, decides to enlist in the Marines and says, I'm going to get involved in this war effort. And this comes after a few years where he was really struggling to figure out what to do after boxing and moving around, and his life wasn't really coming together. He goes and fights in the Battle of Guadalcanal against the Japanese and emerges a war hero. How?
Well, it's a crazy, you know, I'd always heard the story that he told himself, which was basically his fight career was over. Fighters, you know, athletes in general, I think, are very sad guys usually when their career ends. You figure they peaked at 25 or 26. What are you going to do with the rest of your life? And Barney had had a cocktail lounge here in Chicago called the Barney Ross Cocktail Lounge. He could play the piano by ear. He loved to sit in the lounge. And he was just a guy, you know, fundamentally a lonely man. But he surrounded himself as an extrovert would with, you know, all the sort of glad-handers and people around him. What the conventional story was that he hears Roosevelt, you know, saying the day that shall live in infamy, and he says, I'm going to go to war. But I always was skeptical of that because there was a lot of boxers that went into the Coast Guard. Jack Dempsey had a sort of crew of guys in the Coast Guard, all the famous champions. All they had to do was tour the country fighting and raising money. Barney said, no, I want to see combat. And he's way too old. He's 32 at Pearl Harbor, 33 he goes into the Marines. And even the commanders in Camp Pendleton out in California said, stay, you can teach the guys to box. So he did that for him. I said, no, I want to see action. And they shipped him out. He was in the 2nd Marine Division. Guadalcanal was the turning point, of course, just horrific carnage on this jungle island in the Solomons. And Barney emerges from that as almost a freak occurrence. He's out on patrol one night with some of his a small group are going up the river, and they're ambushed by a much larger party of Japanese. And Barney basically single-handedly saves the lives of several of his wounded comrades. He's wounded himself. He's rolling around in a shell crater with all these different rifles to let the Japanese think that there's a bigger force against them. He kills 22 Japanese and says he was sort of praying all night, the Jewish prayer, the Shema Israel, and talking to his dead father. Somehow he emerged from that. Now, I got to know his brother George Rassoff in Niles, and I asked him, I said, why did your brother go to the Marines? And he told me, frankly, that he thought he was going to go to the war and die. He was so depressed that he'd lost all his money and that he just felt like he was a failure at 30. He said, I'm going to go out fighting. And by freak occurrence, he came back smelling like a rose. He arrives back in the States in March of 1943, has to be the only Marine at Camp Pendleton that has a Hollywood agent. Yeah. Everybody wants to play him in the movies. You know, there's articles that saying, you know, Humphrey Bogart and George Raft and Jimmy Cagney, all the tough guy actors wanted to play Barney Ross. And there ended up being a wonderful actor, of course, John Garfield, options his life story. But because Barney was wounded in the war, he did become addicted to morphine. And the story that they optioned, the Barney Ross tale, is exists as a great boxing movie of 1946 called Body and Soul. But it's no longer the Barney Ross story because the public news of his addiction, it was too taboo a subject back then. So he never really got his due. You know, his fame that emerged from the war, he did war bonds rallies and was on stage with Eleanor Roosevelt.
But he wasn't able to cash in on it in a big way.
Well, yeah, he was a strange guy because he sort of missed his beat. Like, you know, people ask me, well, why is he so forgotten? And I said, a lot of it is just the fluke of history. If you look at a guy like Jake LaMotta, who was a tough fighter but a really unsavory man, you know, it takes a great filmmaker like Martin Scorsese in the 80s, well, late 70s, 1980, this great movie, Raging Bull, comes out, so everybody knows Jake LaMotta's story. Similarly, you know, Somebody Up There Likes Me is with Paul Newman. If a filmmaker had sort of captured Barney Ross, I think, in the 70s with a great character actor, you know, an Al Pacino or a Dustin Hoffman playing him, oh, I think everyone would know Barney Ross. But they made his story too early. When they did finally make the Barney Ross story, it was called Monkey on My Back in 1957, and it was a straight junkie movie. It was all about being a heroin addict, which was really a very brief point in his life. And
he kicked it eventually.
Yeah, of course. You had to turn yourself in for arrest at that point. He went into the U.S. Army Public Health Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky. But he went cold turkey. And he then, to his great credit, toured the country, basically telling kids, you know, in schools about the reality of drug addiction. And talks before the United States Congress had hearings into addiction in the 50s. And Barney's up there saying, treat this as a medical problem, not as a criminal justice problem, which is still the debate we're having. I mean, he was a real... You know, that's another reason to write this book. You asked me, what about Barney? I think he just sort of touched these moments in history. You know, I haven't even mentioned he touched on the sort of founding of the State of Israel. He was like Zelig in Woody Allen's, you know, movie.
Yes.
Sort of all these characters, that, you know, Jack Ruby and Al Capone, of course, he worked for him as a young boy. Barney was one of these sort of emblematic lives of the 20th century.
These and so many other stories are contained in the new biography. It's called Barney Ross. It's written by Douglas Century. By the way, in addition to the book, you can catch Doug Ross speaking tonight as part of the next book series. It takes place at Martyrs on Chicago's North Side on North Lincoln Avenue. He'll be there with Rick Kogan in conversation tonight at 7 p.m. Doug, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, really? It's great to be here in Chicago. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Thank you.
Still to come on 848, Exploring the God Factor. I'm Steve Edwards. Stay with us for that and more as 848 continues after this break on Chicago Public Radio.